This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
So, good morning. And thank you for inviting me to this very interesting symposium. Can you hear me? Yes? If not, make visible signs of discontent. In the London Gazetteer of August 18, 1768, Lieutenant James Cook noted that the aim of his first Pacific voyage was to attempt some new discoveries in that vast unknown tract. 5 years later, during Cook's second voyage in December 1773, Johann Reinhold Foster, speaking for himself and ultimately his son George, noted that his motivation for joining the voyage was, and I quote, "the thirst for knowledge and the desire of discovering new animals and new plants for the benefit which should accrue to science and the additions to human knowledge in general." That is, while Cook's vision was originally focused on new geographic and astronomical knowledge, Foster was searching for biological and ultimately anthropological knowledge. Although both Cook and the Fosters succeeded in making new discoveries, their successes do not necessarily lie in the visions of Cook and the Fosters or their patrons, but at least partly in the luck of being the right people in the right place at the right time. As far as Cook and the Admiralty were concerned, the purpose of the first voyage was to observe scientifically the transit of the planet Venus from the vantage point of Tahiti, only recently discovered for the Western world by his countryman, Captain Samuel Wallace. The purpose of the second voyage was to search for the great southern continent that was believed to exist by geographers of the time. And the purpose of the third voyage was to search for a northern passage between the Atlantic and Pacific oceans. So strictly speaking, all three voyages might be considered failures. The observations of Venus were disappointing. A great southern continent was not recognized, and a northern passage between the two oceans was not found. But as far as the Fosters were concerned, the purpose of the second voyage, meaning to contribute to the scientific knowledge of the world through collecting and publication, strictly speaking, there were problems here also. Many of the new plants and animals had been previously discovered and collected during the first voyage by Banks and Solander. More significantly, the Fosters' biological and anthropological specimens, although collected systematically, were widely scattered, and there was no systematic publication of the botany, zoology, geology, or anthropology by the Fosters or anyone else. During the third voyage, no official scientists were taken on the voyage, but many biological and cultural objects were collected. A significant part of these went into the private museum of Sir Ashton Lever, called the Holofousikon. This museum was transferred by lottery and eventually sold at auction in 1806 in more than 7,000 lots. I've been doing research, and we'll call it detective work, on locating the objects and the specimens from this collection for many years, and we'll come back to this at the second part of my talk. Now, the geographic information and mapping was the most systematic and relevant to the British Admiralty and immediately published, but it took some 200 years before the description, analysis, and publication of many of the scientific specimens and artifacts was completed. Yet, as far as Pacific ethnography is concerned, it can still be concluded that the importance of these voyages have never been surpassed, either before Cook's time or since. One should note, however, that this was not some great new British idea. The British had been preceded in the Pacific for more than two centuries by other European countries. It was advances in technology, navigation, medicine, and scientific classification, as well as good luck, that were at least partly responsible for the success of the voyages, even though they did not answer all the questions that they set out to answer. Indeed, some 70 years later, when the American Charles Wilkes set sail into the Pacific on the U.S. exploring expedition, he too was looking for new discoveries and had much the same purpose as Cook's second voyage, that is, to explore the South Polar Sea to find out if land or a continent existed there, and to provide charts for safer navigation, to extend the boundaries of science, and to promote trade. Cook's three voyages, and those of the following century, may have opened to the Western world entirely new vistas of geographic and scientific knowledge, but these new discoveries to the Europeans had been known to Pacific peoples for hundreds of years. Indeed, from the point of view of Pacific Islanders, the encounter has more aptly been described as fatal impact. Discovery and integration of knowledge operated in both directions. Cook and his companions had as much difficulty fitting their new knowledge into 18th century European views of the world as Pacific people had in fitting these strange white men and their curious ships into indigenous Pacific worldviews. Europeans were astounded by the natural and artificial curiosities they encountered, appreciative of the arts, appalled by some of the customs, and in the following century, full of zeal to change their religion. While Pacific peoples quickly accommodated their worldviews to incorporate these strange new white people and their jealous gods. Thus, in addition to European visions of Cook and the Fosters towards science, curiosity, and art, there is another equally important vision, that of the indigenous peoples and their own views of science, curiosity, and art. And there has been a parallel line of inquiry derived from oral tradition and memory to incorporate into a broader view. To deal with all of these views in any systematic way would take slightly more time than allotted to me, so I will focus on two aspects: the present-day distribution of the ethnographic collections made by George and Reinhold Foster, and tracing the collections of the Leverian Museum, which in the late 18th century had the largest collection of Cook Voyage ethnographic objects. As early as the 16th century, when Portuguese, Spanish, and Dutch voyages ventured into the great unknown, their countrymen were curious about the natural history and geography of exotic places, as well as the varieties of people found there and their works. Scientists especially were eager to learn about the varieties of environments, plants, animals, and peoples, as well as the natural and artificial curiosities made by God and people. Books and visual images about these places were widely circulated. Cabinets of curiosities grew, and naturalists wanted first-hand experience in these distant places, as well as collections for scientific study and classification. An important point about the ethnographic collections from Cook's voyage is that they form the baseline collections for several Polynesian islands. They mark the end of strictly indigenous fabrication and from which change can be postulated. Of Cook's three voyages, the collections made during the second voyage were the largest, and the collections made by the Fosters were the most systematic. Nevertheless, collections by their very nature are selective, depending on the quality of contact as well as the length of time spent in an area. And of course, complete statements about the botany, zoology, or culture of any group visited on the voyages cannot be made or even suggested. George and Reinhold Foster, as well as their scientific assistant, Andrew Sparman, acquired a large number of ethnographic artifacts during their visit to the Pacific Islands. The Fosters apparently collected systematically, often collecting two or more of the same artifact type, just as they collected natural history specimens. However, the artifacts were not distributed systematically. On their return to Europe, the artifacts were given away piecemeal and sold to people and institutions that were, or could be, useful to the Fosters financially and or prestigiously. Indeed, the Fosters probably collected duplicate objects specifically with the idea of selling them. Several years earlier, when Reinhold and George Foster first arrived in London, they supported themselves by selling coins, fossils, idols, manuscripts, and other artifacts that they had brought back from when they were in Russia. And now they had even more exotic objects. Thus, attempting to locate the entire collections made by the Foster is primarily detective work. So here is a summary of what I have learned and located so far. The largest and widest ranging collection made by the Fosters is in the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, England. This collection of some 200 catalog entries and 220 objects was given by Reinhold to the Ashmolean Museum in February 1776 after receiving an honorary degree of Doctor of Civil Laws in November 1775. The next most important collection is in the Institut und Sammlung für Völkerkunde in Göttingen. This collection was sold to Göttingen in 1799 after Reinhold's death for 80 thaler. Its some 157 listed pieces is similar in scope and variety to the collection in Oxford and was apparently Foster's own systematic collection that he had retained for himself, although it does not include many unique items and diminished over the years by giving away and selling pieces. Making a definitive list of the Foster collection has taken a great deal of work, and it became part of a larger Cook Voyage collection bought from George Humphrey in 1782. That is, the Humphrey collection was in Göttingen before the Foster collection in 1782, and the Foster collection was purchased in 1799. A third important Foster collection is in Wurlitz. This collection of 31 pieces is housed in its own special building in the gardens of Wurlitz Castle, a large 18th century English-style country house and gardens near Dessau, Germany. The objects were given or purchased by Prince Leopold Friedrich Franz, a friend and patron of the Fosters. A fourth and yet unlocated collection of 41 pieces was once in Mitau, Latvia, and may no longer exist. According to Otto Klemann in a letter from Reinhold and George Foster in Mitau, Mitau is in Latvia, Baron Heinrich von Offenburg bought 41 pieces from the Fosters in 1779 and gave them to the Kurländischen Gesellschaft für Literature and Kunst in 1820. The 41 pieces were mainly clothing and ornaments from so-called Tahiti or Otaheite. And this collection, however, may have been destroyed during World War II. There are other collections which I won't go over in detail, and you will note in the exhibition that there is a diagram made by Ian Coates of trying to show the distribution of the collections made by the Fosters, and you'll see there are bits and pieces from many different museums, including the St. Petersburg Kunstkammer, in which there are three pieces of bark cloth attributed to J.R. Foster. Finally, George Foster gave Tahitian bark cloth to Caroline Michaelis, the daughter of a Göttingen professor. Caroline had the cloth made into a ball gown, which was described by Caroline in a letter of January 1779 to her friend Julie von Studnitz. This is what she said. I received a large package of this cloth from George Foster with a very nice note. To keep my promise, I had made a shepherdess outfit like one sees in the gala night to wear to the ball. The material is white, and the whole is decorated with blue ribbons and is, in truth, very pretty. But you would have to see how much this dress, when I wore it for the first time, was touched and looked at. I can still say at present that it is unique and inimitable. Until now, at least, it will perhaps stay so, because I believe that Foster has no more of this material to give. Now, in the 18th century, scientific classification was an important matter. Reinhold, a natural historian, was trained in the new Linnaean methods, while George seems to have taken classification as a given and went on from there. Thus, when attempting to deal with their artifact collections, both Fosters found it necessary to classify them. But how? In the 18th century, anthropology was not considered a separate scientific subject. At that time, the study of human society and culture was largely an amalgam of observations made by navigators, missionaries, and other travelers that had been preceded by philosophers, historians, and adventure writers, all of whom had distinct preconceptions about non-Western peoples that affected the selection and presentation of information about them. Although they studied natural history together, Reinhold did it consciously toward an end, primarily as classification and the comparative tradition, as well as his own advancement, while George just learned it as part of his upbringing. Thus, more of an empiricist, the materials presented by George are much more useful to ethnography today, and especially to Pacific Islanders, to whom Reinhold's opinion as to how they relate to Greeks and other classical or Western cultures is nearly irrelevant. In the list and description of artifacts sent to Oxford, probably prepared by George, the materials are classified by area, whereas the list presented from the Göttingen collection was arranged by artifact type, as is the listing in Wurlitz. The Sparman collection in Stockholm, also collected by the same group of people, is published by artifact type. The artifact type lists were similar to the systematic organization of plants and animals and could be prepared by a knowledgeable taxonomist, while the area listings required ethnographic knowledge and could only be accomplished by someone like George, who had collected and studied them. The Oxford collection, because it is accompanied by a detailed listing of the artifacts by area, is a key for understanding all second voyage collections and indeed the material culture of the islands visited during the second voyage. In addition, the important illustrations by Hodges and by George Foster add information for identification, use, and significance. When used together, the Fosters' artifact collection, their writings about them, and the illustrations form a treasure for ethnohistorical research for the islands visited. A jewel within this treasure is the collection from Tonga. And if you've gone through the exhibition yet, you'll see there are many objects from Tonga. Tahiti and New Zealand were visited during the first voyage, and baseline collections and information were collected and written about by Captain Cook and Joseph Banks and illustrated by Parkinson and others. The collections from Marquesas, Easter Island, New Hebrides, New Caledonia were also extremely important, but contact was short and the collections small. From Tonga, however, the collections are large and varied, and at least 150 pieces can be identified that were collected by the Fosters. Now, George Humphrey, the other collection that is in the Göttingen Museum and on exhibition here, George Humphrey was a London dealer in natural history and also interested in shells. Nevertheless, he was also a dealer and a collector of ethnographic objects and was known to be knowledgeable about them. The sale of Humphrey's own private collection in 1779, which included 182 lots of ethnographic objects, had been forced upon by his creditors. But this was before Cook's ships had returned from their third voyage. We know that Humphrey went to Cook's ships when they arrived after the second and third voyages, and bought whatever he could from whomever he could. He also bought at sales and auctions, which can be traced by examining the annotated sale catalogs of 18th century auction houses. Cook's third voyage ships returned to England in August 1780, but it was not until several months later that Humphrey was commissioned to put together a collection for Göttingen. By this time, important pieces would be difficult to find. One of the important auctions that Humphrey attended was the sale of the collection of David Samwell. Samwell served as surgeon's mate on the Resolution from February 1776 to August 1778, when he was transferred to the Discovery as surgeon to replace William Anderson, who had died on the voyage. Samwell's collection was sold at auction in June 1781. In the only known annotated copy of the sale catalog, Humphrey is shown to have bought a number of lots, and of these purchases were certainly part of the collection that he sold to Göttingen. And you'll see in the collection that many of the really important objects are the ones that came from Humphrey and not the ones that came from Foster. And I hope you appreciate that this was a dealer who put this together for the King of England to be sold to Göttingen. Now, to move on to another important collection, I want to familiarize you with the Holocaust, and I can't figure out how to turn this on. Oh, there it is. Holocaust is a word, it's a Greek word, which means embracing all of nature. And this was a collection put together by Ashton Lever, a private collector who began his collection in Manchester, England, moved it to Leicester Square in the early 1780s, and then lost it by lottery. And this was the way you disposed of things in the late 18th century in England. He actually tried to sell his collection at a very low price to the British Museum, but Sir Joseph Banks, who was not a friend of his, said to the British Museum, there was nothing in it worth having. And so the British Museum, unfortunately, did not have the opportunity to have all of the wonderful pieces that I will, some of which I will show you from the Leverian Museum. After he lost his collection by auction, it went to a Mr. Parkinson, and it was then called the Leverian Museum. So the Holofusikon and the Leverian Museum are two stages in the same thing. This is an illustration when it was moved into its new home, which is it was at the Surrey side of Blackfriars Bridge. So those of you that know London, go across Blackfriars Bridge, and it was right there in Albion Place. And as you can see, it was very large collection of birds, and there were also animals, and it included not just Cook Voyage collections, but collections from all over the world. And it included a section of monkeys grotesquely set up. And this was one of the monkeys grotesquely set up, and it was called the scribe, or the clerk of the monkey room. And as you can see, because this is a contemporary photograph, the scribe still exists, and he is in a small museum in South London called the Cumming Museum. So if you're ever in London, in the South London, go to the Cumming Museum and see our monkey grotesquely set up. Now, in the Leverian Museum, Ashton Lever was a man way ahead of his time, and he had a number of illustrations made by a watercolor artist named Sarah Stone, and there are two sketchbooks of her drawings, which are in the Bishop Museum. There are two others, one in the Australian Museum, Sydney, and another in the British Museum. So there were four sketchbooks altogether. And the sketchbooks have been very important in trying to locate the objects that I was looking for, which were primarily the ethnographic objects from Cook's voyages. And I'll just show you a few of those. Now, when Kalaniopuu, the high chief of the island of Hawaii, visited Captain Cook on a ceremonial occasion, he brought to him a number of artifacts that were his gifts to Captain Cook, including a feather helmet that is being worn by Kalaniopuu, and he had lying in the front of the canoe, there were six feather capes, including one that we're going to follow its biography. The feather cape that's lying on the top actually went with Cook's collection to the Leverian Museum. After Cook died in Hawaii, after he was murdered in Hawaii, after third voyage, the materials from his collection did not go to the British Museum, but to Sir Ashton Lever's Museum, including the feather cloak and helmet that were worn on the occasion with from Kalaniopuu. Here's a drawing done by Sarah Stone of that particular cloak. And I'll just tell you a little bit about its biography and where it is now. The feather cloak you see there was actually in the Leverian for some time. And the next slide is supposed to be a picture of the of Zoffany's death of Captain Cook. And the reason it's there is because when the artists of the late 18th century needed objects to clothe their people in their paintings, they often appear to have gone to the Leverian Museum and used the featherwork and other objects for their paintings. And in the picture by Zoffany that you can't see, there is Captain Cook formed in the image of the Discobolus, being a famous statue, I guess we'll just call it that, Roman statue that was in the Townley collection in London. And eventually that's going to come up. And you'll see that that Zoffany's Cook is actually wearing the feather cloak that I just showed you the picture of. Now, what happened to it after that? It was in the Leverian Museum. It went to its new home in Blackfriars Bridge. And after Blackfriars Bridge, it was sold at auction in 1806. And after the sale, it was purchased by a man named Atkinson, who was another dealer in ethnographic artifacts. And it was in his collection for some time until it went into another museum, the museum this time of George Bullock, who had a collection in a place in London called the Egyptian Hall. And in the Egyptian Hall, he had a number of very important ethnographic artifacts, again, that had come from early collections, including those from the Leverian Museum. And in the Leverian Museum, there were many objects that were bought by many different people. There were 7,800 lots altogether, and I have been trying to find the 7,800 lots. You see why it's taken me some time. Actually, I found quite a number of them. And I have actually just finished my book, which is called Holofusikon, and it will be published by the Museum for Völkerkunde in Vienna. Now, why Vienna? Because they were one of Leopold von Fichtel from Vienna was one of the largest collectors, largest purchasers at the 1806 sale. And the 1806 sale was the beginning of the Museum for Völkerkunde in Vienna. And so it is the only collection that retained its association with the Leverian Museum. Now, all of the others seem to have lost their association with the Leverian Museum along the way. The slides that you're not seeing were actually objects that were in the Leverian Museum and went to various different places, including Vienna and a very large collection that was purchased by a purchaser named Mr. Rowe, and he distributed these to two of his relatives, and there were very large collections in Bridwell House in Devon and another collection in Widdicombe House, also in Devon. And these two people had a number of pieces that are now very famous objects in the Cambridge collection and also in a number of private collections throughout the world. So these pieces have moved around from place to place to place, have been purchased over and over again, and they are now collected, let's say, or they will be collected in my book, and hopefully you'll be able to read about them and see the pictures that we can't see. So I think we're about out of time, and if you find the slides, I'll show them to you along the way.
I have no idea. That was marvelous. Two fantastic papers, and we now have time for some questions.
I've got a question for Adrian, and it's something that really just suddenly struck me in relation to the loss of documentation, because in many ways what you're showing, certainly in the case of Foster's, was that the collections were very systematically done, that there were records. And also in the ways that people were illustrating them and using them, people were producing context at that particular moment in time. And then it seems that actually that particular documentation got lost reasonably rapidly. And I wonder whether, in the case of the other scientific collections, the plant collections and those particular kind of things, whether there's the same history of loss of documentation. If there isn't, why is this the case with the artifacts, that there's this history of people originally being systematic in their particular collections and treatment of them, and then this whole period where somehow they lost that sort of systematic position?
I'll try to answer that. The botanical specimens, I think, never lost their documentation. And the botanical specimens went into places like the British Museum and were loved by the scientists, whereas the ethnographic artifacts apparently were curious objects, but they weren't really loved in the way that science could look at them. And as I said last night, actually a lot of the ethnographic objects went into collections where I like to characterize it as collections in search of a subject, because there wasn't really any subject to put them into. And although the Fosters were very good at doing things such as classification and so forth, most people were not interested in that. But they had them in their cabinets of curiosities, and they didn't put any little labels in those cabinets of curiosities, so that when the person who collected them moved on to something else, died, gave them to their children, there simply was never any original documentation. So that it's not that they lost their documentation, it's that it was never there to begin with. And even in the British Museum, you'll find, if you look in the early Book of Presence, as it's called, they'll say Mr. Banks or Mr. Weber or whomever gave 18 objects, but it doesn't tell you which ones they are, right? So you're looking at 18 objects, so okay, which ones could they be? And so even in museums that one would expect to have documentation, the documentation is really lacking. And so it's only places like, for example, the Leverian Museum that have these illustrations that you can move along with the illustrations as well as the sale catalogs and then put things together. But I'm really a stickler for details, and I really want to have a paper trail if actually I'm going to give them a Cook Voyage Providence. Did I answer your question?
Thank you very much for both those papers and your very informative one, Adrian. I'm interested in your comment about the most important parts of the collections came from Humphreys, the dealer, and not Forster, the scientific collector. So I'm interested in why this might be. I know to some extent it was kind of embedded in the lead-up to that in terms of the circumstances, but what does it reveal about the values and or circumstances of each of these characters, and what sort of, I guess, what part does what Paul referred to as philosophical conjecture have in this answer?
I don't know about philosophical conjecture, but When I said that, I meant that the artifacts that are on exhibit here, such as the Tahitian mourner costume, which we heard much about this morning. The Tahitian mourning costume actually came from Humphreys. It didn't come from Foster. The feathered god image from Hawaii came from Humphreys, not from Foster. And so many of the very, let's call them significant pieces, were actually in the Humphrey collection. Now, the Fosters went into the villages in various places because they were actually looking for botanical specimens. They were looking for animals, if there were any. And they diverted from the beach. They went into the interior, where they also found villages, houses, people to talk to, and exchange artifacts. So what they exchanged with the people in the villages are usually utilitarian objects, and which are really very important, but they're not the, shall we say, illustrious pieces. And the pieces such as the neck rests, the tongue and neck rests, of which there are several, and they're beautiful sculptural pieces. Several of them came from the Fosters. Several of them also came from George Humphrey. So that was really my own take on it, that the real significant pieces actually came from Humphrey. I don't know about philosophical conjecture.
Maybe in the center there.
I have a question for Adrian, and it carries on about the question we had before about the loss of documentation. And I was wondering whether or not you could comment about the situation in 18th century England, where so much of these discoveries were driven by a love of exotica and the value that these artefacts and the natural history and botanical specimens were given and put into museums. Can you speak about what caused this to diminish and why these things then were may not have been seen to be important enough to keep a record of? I mean, what caused the change in cultural preferences to lose that love of exotica?
My conjecture is that people are always looking for something new. Now, during first voyage, the things that were new were from New Zealand and from Tahiti. During second voyage, especially Tonga, were things that were new. During third voyage, the things especially from Hawaii were new. And then it seems like more explorers went out into the Pacific, more explorers visited the northwest coast of America, and as more and more things came in, the original objects that came from Cook diminished in their curious nature because there were many more and more. And then it just seems like we have ideas like a pendulum. They go back. Sometimes we're interested in Cook, and then we're not. And then maybe 20 years later, we're interested in Cook again, and then we're not. When I did my exhibition in Hawaii called Artificial Curiosities in 1778, it was because that's when Hawaii was first found by Europeans. And so it was very important at that point. But I must say, during the time from 1778, 1779, and so forth, until now, people haven't really been that interested in Captain Cook, or it doesn't seem to me that they have. There's always been a little sustained group who are interested, but the public doesn't seem to be that interested. So I think it's just fashion. Today we're interested, tomorrow we find something new, then we go back again, and otherwise I don't know.
You might have heard the director mention that there was a comment in the local press about the sample, the specimens mouldering in Göttingen.
Yeah.
The material obviously presents very special challenges from a point of view of conservation. A lot of the material is very volatile. Since there are parallel collections that have existed in Göttingen and Pitt Rivers for two centuries, would you care to comment on the relative state of conservation between the two collections?
the hot seat.
Uh-oh. Actually, I'm not doing this just to be flip, but actually, they're both in very good condition. The ones in Oxford have been on exhibit and loved for many, many years by the curators there. And they have really been looked after very well. And there was a wonderful exhibition there in 19. I forget what year I'm in. 1970s, I think it was. And there was conservation on those objects at that time. And so if anything was found to have been soiled or anything, they took care of it in the 1770s. And then they were put back into their into a different exhibition up on the second floor at the Pitt Rivers. The collection in Göttingen had a slightly different history. After Blumenbach died, Blumenbach was the one who was hoping to get the collection for Göttingen. After Blumenbach died, many of the objects, and perhaps most of them, really went into storage for a long time. And so they were not really loved for some time. Then they went back on exhibition, and they have been on exhibition for a number of years, but everything deteriorates over time. And before they went to Hawaii, there was a great deal of conservation done, I believe, by a New Zealander. And the conservation was very well done. He did a lot of work. And when they traveled to Hawaii, they were in very good condition. And as you'll see in this exhibition, if you haven't looked yet, that many of them are still in very good conservation. The Hawaiian feather helmet, I like to tell this story because the feather they had at one time they had a feather cape, and the feather cape and helmet were both stolen in 1932. And after some time, the helmet was found in the courtyard of a Berlin castle. And it was being used for target practice by the Russian soldiers who were in that part of Berlin. And I like to say, they must have really been bad shots because they don't seem to have hit it. And if you look at the feather helmet today, I mean, it is in almost perfect condition. And that was collected, you know, in 1778 or 9. And, you know, that's a long time ago. And, you know, they're really in very good condition, no moths or anything. Whereas if you go to Florence, for example, where there is a Cook collection which is not in good condition, you'll see the feather capes. All of the feathers have been eaten away. There's only the back ground of it. So the ones in Göttingen and Pitt Rivers, very good condition, and I think they've really been loved all the time that they've been there.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.